Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pace. Tomorrow is the day we've all been waiting for. The never-ending 2016 presidential campaign will finally come to an end. And while that race has garnered most of the headlines over the past year, Californians have a lot of other big decisions to make. We need to choose a new U.S. senator. We need to choose whether or not to re-elect our 53 members of Congress, a third of our state Senate, and all 80 of our state assembly members. We'll also decide on 17 state ballot measures, as on numerous local races and measures, only 24 here in San Francisco, by the way. So tonight, we explore the biggest decisions facing California voters. We're joined by several guests tonight who will help to make sense of this all. Joining me here in the studio is Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW. It's great to have you here with me, Ben. It's
a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
And also by phone, we're joined by Joe Garofoli. He is senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And later on, we'll be joined by Mark DiCamillo. He's director of the nonpartisan Field Poll, considered by many to be California's leading public opinion poll. And we invite you, our listeners, we're going to do something a little different tonight. We invite you, our listeners, to join us at the top of the hour. We're going to open our phone lines now so you can get in on this conversation. If you voted already, tell us how you voted and why. If you haven't voted, tell us how you're planning to vote. Or if you have questions, what are you noodling about tonight that you need to figure out by tomorrow? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or follow us at Twitter at cityvisionskalw. So, Joe, from the San Francisco Chronicle, I wanted to start with you. Let's talk about the main event for tomorrow. Let's start with the presidential race. So, would you hazard a guess as who's going to win tomorrow?
I will hazard a guess, but I will also let you know that my record of predictions is terrible. I will admit to about a year ago, I predicted the next president would be Scott Walker. So I have a terrible record of prediction. Right now, it looks like all is trending in Secretary Clinton's favor. Some of the late polls that are coming in, particularly like in New Hampshire, which is part of her quote-unquote blue wall, the key states that you really can't lose, are now trending in her direction. And in a great sort of, as someone told me today, a great political payback, the early vote, in particular from Latino voters in Florida and Nevada, are turning those states and putting them in her column, which is, of course, an incredible payback, as I said, given all the things that Donald Trump has said about Latinos from the very first day of his campaign. So at this point, I know there's been a lot of liberal bedwetting, as it has been called, but I think the sheets should be dry right now.
Do you have a sense of the margin we're talking about here?
It's very difficult. I've seen it's going to be maybe 3-5%. But if this trend continues, it could be larger than that, and that will have a trickle down effect on the rest of the ballot. Nancy Pelosi was in here the other day. We were talking with her about the chances of the Democrats taking back the House of Representatives. They're going to need about 30 seats. Highly unlikely to do that. And even she, she's always a very relentlessly positive about the chances of taking back the House, even when they have no chance. She said it's probably going to be around 20, but in the early results, if the listeners are following this stuff, and they start to see 10 seats come up, Democrat, a net of 10 seats on the first wave of East Coast states announcing their results, there's an outside chance they could win the House.
And how about the Senate?
The Senate looks right now like it's going to be a 50-50 split, at least if a couple of seats, if the Democrats win a couple of seats in Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, which are still pretty close to call, it could go a little bit higher, but it's the narrowest of margins. Of course, the significance of that is going to be that it will be easier for Secretary Clinton, or President Clinton, I should say, to get a Supreme Court justice appointed to the court. But it's not going to be easy because we've already heard Republicans say we're going to jam any kind of nominee that she brings, even if it's Merrick Garland or whomever. So dysfunction and discord awaits no matter who the next president will be.
It's amazing anyone wants this job, huh?
Yeah, so you get free housing, you get a car and a plane, but there's a lot of other headaches.
You get a legacy.
Right.
Yes, for better or worse.
You get to build a presidential library and all that good stuff. Okay, we actually do have Mark DiCamillo, who's just joined us, the director of the Nonpartisan Field Poll. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're doing well. We're just getting started here, and we were talking about the presidential election, the Senate and the House race on the national level. Wanted to back up a little bit and find out what your take is on where California's electorate is or going to be tomorrow. Specifically, what's the makeup ethnically, and how's it going to be different perhaps than other parts in the country or similar?
Well, in California, the big news or the big long-term news has been the growing political might of the ethnic voting population. That's going to demonstrate the blue state of California is becoming bluer with each passing election since the demography of the state becomes increasingly ethnic. We're looking at an electorate that could be between 38% and 40% ethnic, in the sense that it would be Latinos, African Americans, Asian Americans voting, and the receding of the white non-Hispanic voter to about 60% or so of the vote.
And so do you expect then higher turnouts than you've seen in the last couple of presidential elections amongst Latinos specifically here?
I think as a percentage of the total, no question. I'm not sure about the overall turnout of the vote. It may, we certainly have more voters. The Secretary of State released their numbers on Friday, showing that there are now over 19 million Californians who are registered to vote. I think we'll probably see on the order of 14 million or so voting in this election, but as we saw in the primary, we may have to wait about 2 or 3 weeks to get all those votes counted. There are probably going to be 2 or 3 million votes still uncounted after we get to Wednesday.
And what's your sense of the breakdown between early voting and who's going to wait till tomorrow?
Well, we're thinking that the mail ballots will probably constitute about 60% of the vote. That would be a record high for a presidential election. More and more voters seem to like the opportunity, especially with these long ballots, to vote at their own pace. And using a mail ballot gives voters a better opportunity to review the long ballot.
All right. So speaking of those early ballots, let's go to our first caller here, Ruth Ann from El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi there. I've been trying all day long to get the answer to this question. When media project the status of a ballot measure or a candidate or whatever, are they allowed legally to get the results of mail-in ballots and early voting, or is it only polls that they're relying on? Meaning, I voted early on Saturday. Are those results being used by anybody, or are they just all going to be tabulated tomorrow?
I can certainly answer that. None of the vote is counted, and none of the vote is released until 8 a.m. or 8 p.m., excuse me, on election night in California. And the same would be true in other jurisdictions. You wait until the polls have closed. What you're seeing when you read these or hear these reports of how the early voting is going, it's really just a modeling of the electorate. They're looking at the party registration of the people who have turned in their ballots, and they're then projecting onto that what proportion they think would have gone for Hillary or what portion would have gone for Trump based on that kind of information, party registration and where the ballot is coming from. They're not actually counting that vote. They don't open those ballots until the polls have closed.
Thanks so much, Ruth Ann, for your call. So let's now go back to some of the races here. Let's do the U.S. Senate race here, the Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez. Joe, what's your prediction there?
That could be the easiest one to call for the night. As Mark will tell you, the polls have been in Kamala Harris's favor from the get-go on that. Loretta Sanchez never really had raised enough money to run a decent campaign, and the campaign was also kind of disorganized. And I mean, they just released like an immigration plan a few days ago, so it was a confusing campaign. Another thing that they had the Senate campaign in general kind of suffered from being in the shadow of the presidential race, and I think that didn't get as much attention as they thought it would. And as Mark can tell you, there's going to be one of the most interesting things to see when we count the ballots is how many Republicans sat out this race, because a lot of people, according to the field poll and others, Republicans are just like, you know, this is a race between two Democrats, and they're like, well, you know, we're out on this. We're not picking either of these people, and so we'll see.
So, Mark, what are your polling numbers telling you about how this race is going to go and who's going to be voting tomorrow?
Well, the vote that is going to be cast, I think Joe is absolutely correct. There's going to be an unusually large proportion of voters who actually skip the ballot, and they're mainly going to be Republicans and independents who lean Republican because they don't see any Republicans to choose from. They only see two Democrats, and that's all there is. There's not even a third-party candidate. And so what we're seeing in the polls, and even among those who've already voted, you know, in our final poll, about 23% of the people we talked to had already voted. Harris is way out ahead, on the order of about 2-1. But what's interesting is that 14% of those voters who already voted said that they chose to skip the U.S. Senate race, and again, they're nearly over 9 out of 10 of them are Republicans or Republican-leaning voters. They just don't see the difference between what they perceive as two liberal Democrats, and they refuse to vote for either of them.
All right. So let's turn next to our local Senate race here in San Francisco. I want to turn to you, Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW. So the state Senate race for Mark Leno's seat is between Jane Kim and Scott Wiener. Jane Kim got slightly more votes than Wiener in the June primary, but Scott Wiener has gotten the major endorsements from the including the Chronicle there, Joe, the SF Democratic Party, and Kamala Harris. Of course, Jane Kim was endorsed by Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. So what's it looking like for tomorrow?
Well, it could be pretty unpredictable, I think, considering what happened in the primary back when they were running off together. And so I think that Jane Kim, being a more progressive candidate than Scott Wiener, she could really come through in the end, depending on how many voters are seeing her as a good option. When I think so many voters, for example, are turned off in the presidential race by not having a good alternative kind of candidate, Scott Wiener is much more of a conservative Democrat. He has been one of the most prolific lawmakers I've ever seen in the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. It seems like about every other measure for a long time was coming from Scott Wiener. But Jane Kim has really been proposing quite a few lately. And because she got that endorsement from Bernie Sanders, I think that could really mobilize a lot of San Francisco voters.
Hmm. And so, Mark, what do you think about this race, the state Senate race here in San Francisco? Mark, are you there? Oh, yeah.
Well, yes, but the field poll is not measuring races that are below the top of the that are below the statewide level. The only polling we do is at the statewide level, so I don't have anything for state Senate or for any of the down ballot races.
Okay. All right. Are there any other particular races? Because we're going to move away from races because our phone lines are lighting up with people who want to talk about propositions. So before we move away from races here, are there any other races that people should be interested in looking out for the results of tomorrow that you have some polling data on?
Again, we have the statewide races. So literally the only candidate races that we have in our polls are the two races for president and for U.S. Senate. Those are the only races that are on the statewide ballot, candidate races. All of the others have to do with the statewide ballot proposition.
Got it. Okay. Joe, any races that you want to mention?
Congressional race we should be watching for is the congressional race between the incumbent Mike Honda and Ro Khanna, a challenger who's a second time challenging Honda. This is an interesting race in that it's Honda with long-time labor support, and Khanna seen as sort of the up-and-coming representative of the growing Asian American population in Silicon Valley. So it's a nice race to watch, and it's been very back and forth, all kinds of stuff going on there. And again, since there is limited polling, there's internal polls and such, but this will be one everybody's to be watching. It's not going to change the balance in the House. These are both Democrats and fairly liberal and progressive.
All right. Well, so that's our quick look at the races for tomorrow. I'm going to reintroduce the program at this point. This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about the 2016 election with Mark DiCamillo, director of the nonpartisan field poll, Joe Garofoli, senior political writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. And here in the studio with me, Ben Trefney, news director here at KALW. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments about tomorrow's election. We're going to turn to the propositions, the many, many propositions on the ballot. If you voted, how'd you vote? If you're still struggling over how to decide, what are your questions? Where are you? Which way are you leaning? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at CityVisions, KALW. So let's go to Ari from Berkeley. Ari, you have a question about Prop 61. And just so everyone knows exactly what Prop 61 here, I'm going to use the handy-dandy KLW crib sheet, which you can find on the website. This is the this is the one that would cap the amount the state pays for prescription drugs, generally prohibiting the state from paying any more for drugs than the lowest price paid by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, which pays the lowest prices in the nation. So, Ari, what's your concern? Do we have Ari on the phone? Oh, I'm sorry. We don't. All right. So so let's go back to our panelists here. So,
well, I have a thought about Prop 61 because it seems on the surface like a really attractive measure, right? I mean, this is to lower prices that a lot of people consider to be out of control, bring them down to a level that the government agency, the VA, is paying, which seems fair across the board. But at the same time, there's been so much money put into this to the no on Prop 61 campaign by Johnson & Johnson, by Merck, by Pfizer. I mean, it's like $109 million that's been put into the state proposition to fight it. And I believe, Joe, that the Chronicle actually came out against Prop 61 because they say that it's too dangerous, that actually what it could end up doing is it could raise the price that the VA pays rather than lowering the price that California pays. And I think that that's the concern a lot of people have.
Yeah, and quick notes, and I know you alluded to this earlier about the Chronicle's editorial board. I do not, just for clarification, I do not sit on the editorial board. I'm not a member of it. I don't have voting rights or anything like that. That's their deal, and I have my own deal. It's gotten very little sort of mainline political support. I mean, the Democratic Party hasn't backed it. You don't see a lot of people other than Bernie Sanders is starting commercials for it. And I think the concern is among some people many of these politicians, I believe, is that they're uncertain of what could happen. Would the drug companies then, back off and not offer certain drugs? Do something where they offered substitutes. It's all there. I think it's a concern of the uncertainty that some people have, and those ads, that those $109 million worth of advertising that you alluded to, Ben, is working because the polls are I think it's dead even. It's 47 apiece, isn't it, Mark? And I think seniors are really scared by this because they're concerned. They may be on fixed incomes. They may not, they may not be able to withstand a big price increase, and so it's one of those things that tapped into a lot of concern. concerns that we all have about the cost of drugs. This is one where the power of corporate America came through and overwhelmed is overwhelming. We don't know which way it's going to go, and we don't have a lot of politicians standing up besides Bernie Sanders on this one.
Right. Let's go to the other one that's about corporations. That's the soda tax, also known by its opponents as the grocery tax, and that's here in San Francisco. It's Measure V. In Oakland, I think it's HH. Is that right? Taxing sugar-sweetened beverages, and this would place a tax of 1 cent per ounce on sugar-sweetened beverages, which includes soft drinks, some sports drinks, and some juices. And the tax, interestingly enough, would be levied at the distributor level, not at the point of sale. And so there's lots of interesting questions about how that tax would, the cost of that tax would be spread. So Joe, why did they go for a distributor level taxation, and what's the, and is this concern about increasing the prices of groceries across the board? Is it, how legit is it? Is there any data to support it?
Well, I think the interesting twist on this one was that the opponents of this used Bernie Sanders' words in many of their commercials, or words inspired by Bernie Sanders, that this is a grocery tax, where he said, this is a form of grocery tax. And they kind of twisted it out. They twisted his words, and Sanders eventually came out and said, hey, this is not what I was intending to say here. But it's been a success. It's caused enough confusion that it is that it's hurt this measure, the passage of it. And this is, I think, the second go-around, at least in San Francisco.
That's right.
And I believe it's the first go-around in Oakland on this. So, it's definitely had some there's been a lot of money on this. And this is one that's, again, I haven't seen any recent polling on this, but this is going to be a tight one.
Ben, what's your take on this one?
Well, it failed last time in part because it needed 2/3 of the vote, because they were designating the money for certain programs. And in this case, it only needs 50% to pass. And so even if it's close, it's going to be, only needing half of the voters to put it through. And it's something that's supported by the mayor, by the American Heart Association, by the NAACP. I mean, again, as you were saying, Joseph, I mean, this is one that Big Soda has put a lot of money behind. I mean, tens of millions of dollars into a local proposition is pretty remarkable. And so, again, it's kind of this advertising, but I don't think it's the kind of thing that, the way with Prop 61, how they found a lot of traction by scaring people by saying, well, we might raise the cost for veterans. They had a lot of veterans in the ads for the pharmaceutical industry. In this case, they were calling it a grocery tax because of that distributor model of payment. But I don't think anybody was really buying that. I don't really get that sense. And so I don't think that had the same kind of traction, but we'll see.
All right. Let's go next to the whole there's a suite here of propositions, both statewide and here in San Francisco, on law enforcement. Let's start with Joe here calling from San Francisco, who wants to talk about the death penalty measures. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I guess I thought you didn't have enough Joes on this show already.
Go ahead.
Good point, Joe.
So I voted yes on 62 and no on 66. I voted for those already. I have the sense that there's some
And Joe,
confusion.
Let me before you go into it, let me just update everyone on what those are so that people know what you're
sure.
talking about. So Prop 62 would abolish the death penalty, and all current death row inmates would be resentenced to life in prison without parole. And Prop 66 attempts to reform capital punishment by shortening the time of legal challenges to, I think, about 5 years maximum. Those are the main points there. So you said you voted which way again?
Yes on 62 to repeal the death penalty, no on 66. And I think there's some confusion in the electorate about the impact of 66 or what happens if you vote for both of them. And I think there are a lot of people that don't understand that these are incompatible and competing propositions. So I'm not telling anybody how they should vote, but if you are opposed to the death penalty, you should vote yes on 62, and you should most definitely vote no on 66. I don't think it's hyperbolic to characterize the effect of 66 as allowing the state to kill people faster. And that's really all it accomplishes.
And I would add something to what you said, Joe, is that if both measures pass, then the one with the most votes will become the law. So if, as you said,
exactly.
you want to abolish the death penalty, then you vote yes on 62 and no on 66. If you want to speed up the death penalty, you vote yes on 66 and no on 62.
Exactly.
Right. There's a couple of those like that, those ones where you really have to think about what it means when you vote for one or the other, how your vote may cancel itself out, right? All right. Thanks, Joe, for your call. All right. So sticking with law enforcement, let's go to Prop 57, criminal sentencing. This would increase the number of nonviolent inmates eligible for parole consideration and enable inmates to earn credits for good behavior. Completely separately, it also lets judges decide whether to try a juvenile as an adult rather than prosecutors, the thought there being that fewer younger offenders might be placed into the adult system. Joe and Ben, why did these two things get put together like this? And tell us what's in consideration here. What should people be considering? This was Governor Brown's ballot measure.
I think he was trying to keep propositions off the ballot. There's already so many. He decided to stick a couple together.
Right, right.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see the relation between these two. Joe, do you?
No, I know the governor, he wanted to sort of make amends for what he did as an earlier term as governor, where there was much more rigid sentencing guidelines, and he mm-hmm. wanted to sort of loosen those up and give more leeway to not make it such a hard and fast crime and punishment type of thing. I think that was in his philosophy on this. At least that's what he told us when he came in here.
And that's been a lot of the case since he's had his latest term as governor. With realignment of prisons, the prison population has been shrinking dramatically and being with inmates going into county jails. And so this continues that trend of Governor Brown trying to make up, as you said, for what he was doing in the 70s.
And so how's it looking? We haven't talked about the actual polling on the death penalty measures and this one here, the criminal sentencing reform.
Well, let me jump in on that.
Yes,
one.
Mark.
I can tell you that our latest field poll shows that the Prop 57 initiative for criminal sentences and parole looks comfortably ahead for passage. Voters seem to be in a mood to liberalize in many ways the criminal sentences that have been fairly draconian in the past. So I think that one is fairly comfortably ahead, but the unknowns in the polling are how voters will, in fact, come down on both the death penalty repeal, Prop 62, and the speeding up of the death penalty, 66. Both were close to the 50% margin, although the repeal had slightly more in our final poll, so I think it has a slightly better chance of passage.
All right. And why don't we round out the law enforcement measures with the gun control measure. So tell us a little bit more about this one, Ben. What is it aiming to do?
Well, this has a lot of different ideas that actually, I believe, have already been passed by the state legislature. But there's a lot of political games going on with this. And, Joe, you might have a better feel for it. I forget what the name of the lawmaker who kind of pushed through a lot of these measures before.
Kevin De Leon.
Kevin De Leon.
Yeah.
And it's been kind of a contest between him and Gavin Newsom, who was the one who brought Prop 62, or I'm sorry, Prop 63, Prop 53?
63.
Sorry,
63.
Who brought 63 onto the ballot, but it's kind of redundant, it seems.
Yeah, most of it, there's several points that are redundant. It's basically, instead of talking about gun control, it's just talking about almost ammo control, where you'd have to get a license, if you will, a permit, to buy ammunition. And it would prohibit you from having large-capacity ammunition magazines. So it's a different take. As Vince said, the legislature did pass a lot of this stuff. De Leon, the state senate president from Los Angeles, he asked Newsom. He's like, well, we don't need this anymore. It's superfluous. And then Newsom said, no, it's doing some things. It's codifying it into law. So when you pass a ballot measure, it's harder to overturn. It's going to take more than the legislature passing a law to overturn it. So it's putting it, rooting it in cement, as opposed to in quicksand. That's the political games part of it. Newsom's going to be running for governor in 2018. Being out front on a high profile issue like this helps him out, just like being out front on the marijuana legalization issue is. The strange thing about this one is you think, well, oh Jesus, the NRA is going to come in here and dump a whole ton of money on this, and the NRA is given $95,000, which is what they're carrying around in their pocket most of the time. So it really hasn't attracted it. I think the opposition hasn't even raised $1 million on this. So it's and the supporters are maybe $4.5 million. It hasn't been as high profile as I think many people anticipated, primarily because of the legislature's action and because of there's 16 other ballot measures.
Well, which brings up that question too. I mean, I think that when politicians are bringing up propositions in order to get their name associated with it, that doesn't seem like it's really serving the state that effectively. And I could see why, obviously, with ammunition or gun control, these are important issues, and they're controversial around the country, maybe a little bit less so in California, which is so democratic. But still, I think that when we have in San Francisco itself, when you add Measure RR, 42 ballot measures to consider here, which is so much for all of us to take on, when you have something that's replicating essentially what's going on in the legislature already, it seems like a little bit of a waste of time.
Yeah. Let me reintroduce the program. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. You're listening to City Visions here on pre-election night. We have three experts here in the on the phone and in the studio. In the studio, we have Ben Trefney, a news director here at KALW. On the phone, we have Joe Garofoli from the San Francisco Chronicle. And on the line also is Mark DiCamillo, director of the Nonpartisan Field Poll. Again, opening the phone lines to you, our listeners, to join our conversation. 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment to the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So real quick, back to you, Ben. There's a couple here about policing in San Francisco, G and R. Prop G would make the department, the Office of Citizens Complaints that oversees the police department a more independent body with an independent budget. It would rename it as office or the Department of Police Accountability. And then secondly, R would create would mandate that each precinct would have to have a certain percentage, I think it's about 3% of its police officers dedicated to a neighborhood or I guess they call it quality of life crimes. Any thoughts about how those are going to go down here in San Francisco, especially given the recent departure of our police chief and other high profile concerns around racial bias in the police department?
Right, and the police chief was really forced out. I mean, Mayor Lee was saying that he was going to retain Greg Suhr, and he kept saying it and saying it despite the pressure mounting from the Frisco Five, who eventually ended up putting enough pressure on where when there was just one too many incidents, of course, of an officer-involved shooting, that he ended up leaving office. Prop G, I think that there's obviously some issues with the accountability of the San Francisco Police Department, and I think that taking out Greg Suhr, who is already a reform-minded police chief, and looking for somebody else is, I think Prop G is kind of a statement to say this is not working the way that it's supposed to. And the U.S. Department of Justice, in investigating the San Francisco Police Department, found bias against African Americans, and there have been repeat cases of this sort of thing. So I'm not sure if it's going to be more effective to change the name of a department. Creating a more independent department, that might make a difference. And I do think in a city where there has been so much pressure enough so that it could replace a police chief who's already reform-minded, I could see Prop G really getting some traction. With Prop R, it seems like police departments already walk beats. This would be codifying that to make requirements. And I think that's some of the concern about Prop R. And as we spoke about earlier, whenever the voters put something into action with a proposition, it makes it very hard to take back. If a legislator puts it in, then you can adjust it and make amendments. But with Prop R, to create a neighborhood crime unit, that would make a permanent requirement for a number of the beat cops. And I believe that it is only if the San Francisco Police Department meets a minimum number of police officers, then a certain number of them would have to walk beats, but it would require that. And so it's kind of a set aside of personnel.
All right. Anything you want to add there, Joe?
No, I will defer to Ben on the city stuff. I've been focusing on other areas.
Okay. All right. So let's go next. Let's see. How do we go next here? How about let's look at education? That's an interesting set of propositions here. So 51, school construction. Authorizes $9 billion in bonds to build new schools and modernize existing ones. Most of the money would be for K through 12 schools, with about $2 billion for community colleges. Interestingly enough, Governor Brown's opposed to this one. Joe? Yep.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I lost you there for a second.
I said Governor Brown is opposed to Prop 51. Do you want to say more about that?
No, I'm not going to. I'm going to pass on that one. That's our education writers have been covering that one. Sorry.
Okay, Ben?
Well, Governor Brown doesn't seem to like when you require money for certain set-asides like this. And so he's been fairly fiscally conservative, I think, as a governor who as governor of a Democratic state. But I think that compared to a lot of other governors who we've had in recent years, he's been fairly fiscally conservative, except for maybe when you get into Prop 53 in the revenue bonds, when he has different legacy projects he's considering, like the Delta tunnels. And we could talk more about 53 in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
So when this is a $9 billion bond, I think that he might be worried about the state going into debt. And with a bond of this size, Prop 51, then you're talking about a payback of $17.6 billion. And that's a big chunk of change for the state, even if it's doing well financially. By the way, I wanted to note that this is the first time in 10 years that the state is voting on a bond like this, a $9 billion bond for schools.
Okay. And San Francisco has a couple of measures A and B that are related to education, $744 million for the San Francisco Unified School District, and Prop B, which would extend actually increase the parcel tax from $79 to $99 per parcel, but also will extend it to year 2032. What do you think is going to happen with those two measures? It seems San Francisco voters tend to be pretty supportive of education. Any thoughts there about it? Those two going down?
Well, pretty supportive of education, but, you know, lumping this with Prop 51, which would give some money for community colleges, I mean, Prop B would go to support San Francisco, City College of San Francisco, which has really been under fire for many, many years now. And the accreditation crisis that was going on with San Francisco City College ended up costing it. And just to recap for people who might not know or might not remember, it was in danger of losing its accreditation for a few years for quite a long time when it was under investigation for financial mismanagement. And now it still is under review, and we're not going to know until January if it's in the clear or not. Meanwhile, the accreditation board is actually under fire also for maybe not operating ethically. So ultimately, the bottom line is that City College of San Francisco lost about 40% of its students. It went from about 100,000 students who were going to City College to about 60,000, and that's enormous loss of revenue. So Prop B would extend a parcel tax from something that's expiring next year to expiring in 2032. So that's really important money for City College. However, it had been under watch for financial mismanagement. And I want to note also Prop W, which doesn't specifically say anything about City College, but Jane Kim, who has helped put that on the ballot there, this is a tax for very, very wealthy San Franciscans. And the Board of Supervisors has talked about using that money to maybe make tuition at San Francisco City College free. And so that's where that money unofficially might end up going.
Okay, and that's the Prop W is increasing the transfer tax for properties worth at least $5 million. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for that summary there. Let's go next to Robert from San Francisco, who wants to talk about the cigarette tax. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi. Yes, I wanted to make a comment that this measure is really about criminalizing safer forms of nicotine delivery by taxing the e-cigarettes and nicotine vapor at the same rate. And this really does not save lives. It actually kills a great many people because if you look at all these repressive taxes, the smoking rate in California for adults has gone from 28% of adults to 12% in 2016, while the deaths have gone from 28,500 to 40,000. The death rate has more than doubled, while the smoking rate has gone down by almost two-thirds. So you see that this is not about saving lives or keeping kids healthy. If kids are getting cigarettes now, they're doing it illegally anyway, because it's become very clear in the past 15 years that selling cigarettes or giving cigarettes to kids is highly criminal and is illegal. I mean, it's just not allowed. I don't know where these kids are getting their cigarettes. If 17,000 kids are starting.
The stores get in a lot of trouble if they sell cigarettes to minors.
They lose everything. They risk everything if they do that. So that's they are just lying. And the only other point I want to make, because I know time is limited, is that Big Tobacco and the insurance companies and the hospitals and the California Department of Health have not raised these issues because they're all on the same side of it. Altria, the biggest cigarette manufacturer in the United States, makes Marlboro and everything else. They, in their annual report, say that they want smokeless tobacco, nicotine vapor, for instance, taxed at the same rate as cigarette tobacco. So all of them agree that a safe cigarette is going to cut into their action. It's going to cut into the action because it's going to cut lung cancer by 90%. It's going to cut emphysema by 90%. All the money they make treating nicotine addiction, it's going to take their action away. So, what they are doing is mass murder.
All right, Robert. Thank you so much for your call. So Prop 56 would add a $2 tax to cigarettes, including electronic cigarettes containing nicotine and other tobacco products. And as revenue stream will increase funding for existing healthcare programs. I'm not sure how to parse out the epidemiology there of sort of the decrease in cigarettes and the increase in the death rate, given perhaps that the cigarette smoking may have its impact much later on. But to the point that that Robert was making about sort of the interests here, how do the interests shake out, Ben?
Well, the biggest funder against Prop 56 is Philip Morris USA. And Philip Morris makes Marlboro. And so I don't think that it's any surprise that the tobacco tax is going to have its huge opposition. And again, this is a state measure, and it's been over $50 million. I mean, what I have down from October 21st, so that's actually, what, over 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago, it was $66 million that was put against this. It obviously would be a huge financial hit for the tobacco industry. I can't really speak to what Robert was talking about. However, the FDA, according to the American Lung Association, until it approves a specific electronic nicotine delivery system, then the American Lung Association does not support its use for cessation or any claims that e-cigarettes help smokers quit. And so the American Lung Association does not think that that's a good alternative. And so when you lump these things together, as they have with the tobacco tax, then I think it would make sense to the American Lung Association.
Mark, how is this? Oh, go ahead. Who's that?
Well,
No, Joe, just going to throw in the politics of it, the epidemiology aside. This is also supported, the major supporter of this measure is Tom Steyer, who's the he's a billionaire, former hedge fund manager from San Francisco, environmentalist. He is supporting this, and this is another way. I mean, he also has a personal connection. I believe his mother suffered from lung cancer as a smoker, I believe, his interest in this is coming from. But also, also as a way to, he's thinking and likely to run for governor in 2018, and this is something along with a lot of other money that he's giving out for get out the vote efforts and various other campaigns around the country as a way to sort of bring up his name recognition, because unless you're sort of a political geek, you don't really know who Tom Steyer is.
Okay, Mark, do you have any polling data on this one?
We do. We have it ahead. With our last poll, there were 55% of likely voters intending to vote yes, so its chances are, I think, pretty good. Other polls have showed similar levels of support. So this is something, you know, the cigarette industry has been able to beat back in previous election cycles with large amounts of spending. I think some of the Steyer money is probably keeping it afloat, and I think there are probably better chance of passing this particular measure than what we have seen in the past. So I think it may pass.
All right. And you want to say something else there?
Yeah, one thing, Ben, that I wanted to add, when we were reporting on this at KALW, and just something for voters to think about, too, is that with a measure like this, which is a tax on tobaccos, and it's an expensive tax, right, $2 added per pack. If you smoke a pack a day, then you're talking about $750 plus a year. And you're taxing addicts, so people who don't really have an option so much of whether or not they choose to smoke. I think most smokers who are addicted to cigarettes, they don't really want to be addicted to cigarettes, but it's an addictive, it's an addictive product. And so if you're taxing that, you're taxing people who don't really have a chance to stop. I mean, obviously they would work harder to do that, and I think that's part of the purpose of this, and obviously to stop younger people from smoking, but it's just, it's a, in some ways, it's a difficult one to swallow.
All right. Yeah. Once again, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about tomorrow's election. We're focusing at this point in the hour on the ballot measures. If you want to join our conversation with Mark DiCamillo from the Field Poll, Joe Groffley from San Francisco Chronicle, and Ben Trefney here from KALW, call us. 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions at klw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, excuse me, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So let's go to one of the measures that you mentioned, Prop 53, Ben. Prop 53 would require voter approval before any revenue bond over $2 billion can be issued by the state for state-managed products. Projects, excuse me. So this would perhaps get in the way of how the governor deals with infrastructure issues. Tell us why this is on there. There's an interesting backstory here, right?
Yeah, well, the people who have mostly supported this is a ranching family called the Cortapassis, who live in the Central Valley, and they really don't want the Delta tunnels to be built. And so this is specifically for the kinds of bond projects that will generate revenue to pay it back, and that would be legacy projects that Governor Brown is extremely interested in passing, like the Delta tunnels, which would divert water and help it go through the Delta down to Southern California.
How is this one polling, Mark?
Well, you know, this one has kind of snuck up on us, and we actually didn't even include it when we were making our decisions back in September as to which polls, which propositions to track. We couldn't track all 17. It really has come upon us, I think, only in the past 2 or 3 weeks. So I have not seen any public polling on it. I think it's an interesting one, given that the governor has taken a very visible personal stake in this and tried to frame it as something that would intrude upon local government control, because he's saying that, you know, some major local infrastructure projects, especially in Southern California, may ultimately have to be put before the statewide electorate, and that's the stance he's taking. I don't know what's going to happen. It's really going to turn on the believability of the governor and his message in the on the no side, to see if I think what voters would have instinctively been inclined to vote yes.
Anything to add there, Joe?
Yeah, I think this plays upon, I think, some of the frustrations that voters feel about, you know, these major infrastructure projects, high-speed rail, the Delta tunnels, where, you know, it's hard to for voters to see the long view on these type of things. They're like, well, when are the trains going to be built? When are they going to start? Why are there so many delays? Why are there so many cost overruns? And they extrapolate that to the tunnels and other, and the Bay Bridge project, all these kind of major infrastructure projects, which are so necessary, and certainly in the case of the Bay Bridge. But I think there's a voter frustration there that's doing this, and to get Jerry Brown to spend some of his own money is really saying something. He's put about $4 million from his 24 left over from his governor's run from 2014 into this, and he's starring in commercials, and he doesn't do that very lightly. So this is where he's spending a lot of his political capital right now.
A lot of that talks about, sorry, Joe, it talks about the frustration that citizens have with their government. I mean, you mentioned the Bay Bridge, obviously, which had an initial price tag of $1.5 billion, ended up being $7.5 billion. It was something like that. And it's really understandable why people would really be unhappy with so many different things the government does. And like you said, it's difficult to have a long view. And I mean, we're seeing that on the national level, too, obviously, because there's such high dislikability numbers for both Donald Trump, and even if he's a possible candidate, which is sort of mind-blowing, but since he's there, and then Hillary Clinton also, and people don't trust her as well. So this is not just California, obviously. This is everywhere.
Well, speaking of measures that are about not trusting your elected officials or some of your elected officials, there's, you might imagine, Prop 54, which is trying to put a stop to last-minute lawmaking by requiring the legislature to publish a bill in print and online for at least 72 hours prior to the vote, is a chance to try to increase transparency. Is that really what's going on there? I know there's a millionaire or multimillionaire funder behind that one. What do you make of that one, Joe?
Yeah, the person funding that is Charles Munger, who's also been behind other kind of measures in California, like the top two primary and such. It goes back to the frustration with. These sort of omnibus measures that are like, oh my God, what are we voting on? What are we doing? And they're done often at the 11th hour. We always see the end of the session in Sacramento where there's a mad rush to finish bills. And I think there's a lot of frustration with that. We're oh my God, we pass these bills right before the midnight deadline or the whatever the deadline is. And they're like, well, what the hell did we vote on? And so this is an attempt to address those type of situations.
Okay, and Ben, we have very little time left in the program, but I wanted to quickly get at the measures that are seen as power struggle between mayor and board of supervisors here in San Francisco, specifically the measures around affordable housing and who should oversee it and how contracts are granted. That would be MP and I believe you, and then just establishing the Office of Public Advocate, which is Prop H, and then Prop L, which is giving city supervisors additional control of appointing members to the transportation agency.
You just said all the letters, I think, Joseph.
Did I? There's no letters left.
I think you got all the letters. Yeah. No. This is San Francisco, right? So there's always going to be power struggles between the supervisors and the progressive wing and the more moderate wing. And I think that pretty much everyone that you added there that you noted is something that is trying to take away some of the power, to decentralize some of the power from the mayor's office. And, you know, Mayor Lee is something of a continuation from a policy sense of Gavin Newsom, who was something of a policy sense continuation from Willie Brown. And so I think that the progressive wing, which was Aaron Peskin coming into power this year, I think that they're really trying to make more of a statement, recognize that maybe we can't get the mayor's office, but maybe we can wrest some of the control and keep it with the supervisors. This is obviously one of the strongest issues in the entire Bay Area, not just San Francisco, is affordable housing. And I think that people want to see something done, and that's what a lot of these measures are coming from. But I'm not sure that, I mean, I think that people really need to read these carefully if they have the time to, between now and tomorrow, if they haven't already, and figure out, is adding another office in this case, or another watchdog office to city government, really going to help affordable housing happen more in San Francisco?
Right, or put in more more parts to the process. Okay, so let's go to another caller here. We have Steve from San Francisco who wants to talk about the controversy around plastic bags.
Yes, exactly.
65 and 67.
65 and 67. And propositions you guys had talked about before, and then also would you talk about 60 is the condoms. And RR is BART. So I'll take my answers off the air. Great show.
Basically,
thanks so much, Steve.
If you find a condom on BART, put it in a plastic bag, and then we'll be done.
All right. So really, we have like what, 3 minutes or so left of the engineers nodding yes. So how do we make sense of 65, 67? And if you want to throw 60 in there, go ahead.
Got a quick summary.
Plastic and latex, different. Okay.
I've got a quick summary of 67, 65 to try to make it clear.
Okay.
It's that if you say yes on 67, it will ban the sale of single-use plastic bags in grocery stores. And so 67 will then give money to stores if they sell you a bag. And so that's the way the law was originally intended. This was passed before. So 67 says, yes, do that. 65 would put the money into the environment. But this is another one, and it would not ban the bags. And so this is another one where if one of them gets more votes, then it's going to be the one that wins. But in this case, 67 is the one that environmentalists want you to pass to stop single-use plastic bag sales.
I'm sorry, Ben. I think you did a great job there, but I don't know that I was able to get any more clarity on that.
Well, I'll since we are running out of time,
yeah.
I just wanted to note that we have really short summaries of all these propositions at kalw.org. So if you go to kalw.org, the top right corner, it's an extremely popular election section because we have 2-minute summaries with really short write-ups that explain every one of the state propositions and a lot of the San Francisco propositions. So kalw.org, the election guide in the right-hand corner.
Right. There's a crib sheet you can take to the polls with you tomorrow. There's a place where you can figure out what's actually going to be on your ballot. It's a great resource. And while we're on the topic, what's going on tomorrow night here on KLW for election coverage?
Well, we are going to preempt Cross Currents at 5 p.m. because I think that we're all interested to see what's happening on the East Coast with the polls closing. So NPR will be broadcasting live from 5 to 7 p.m. At 7 to 9, Rose Aguilar is hosting a live election show at the Roxy Theater in the Mission District of San Francisco. And that's going to have live audience. You're welcome to go there. It's free at the Roxy tomorrow night between 7 and 9, hosted by Rose. And then at 9 p.m., I will be hosting a live call-in show between 9 and 11. And we're going to be talking about these returns as the California returns come in, as the local returns come in. And we have two guests, Noah Arroyo from the San Francisco Public Press and Nick Miller from the East Bay Express, and we'll all be talking about that with your calls from 9 to 11 on KALW.
All right, so a full night of election coverage coming here up here on KALW tomorrow evening. So Mark or Joe, any last propositions that you want to say something about, or anything else about tomorrow's election to round it out for us?
Well, I think one of the major ones that will be national news coming out of California will be the likely legalization of marijuana. I think there are a couple others around a couple other states that will also be voting on the same issue and may, in fact, legalize marijuana in other states. So I think of all of the initiatives, the national media will probably be playing that one up the biggest.
All right. And Joe, last word?
All I want to say, I want to go to that party at the Roxy. I'd rather go there. If it's anything like up the Oscars, it's got to be a blast to watch election returns at the Roxy in San Francisco. That's I think I'm going to try and finish my story early so I can go down there and watch.
All right. Well, I want to thank all the callers, listeners that we weren't able to get to tonight, and I want to thank my guests, Mark DiCamillo, director of the Nonpartisan Field Poll, Joe Garofoli of the San Francisco Chronicle, and Ben Trefney, director of news here at KALW. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision's page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join my co-host Ethan Elkind next Monday as we talk about the future of the Republican Party in California. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Happy voting. Good night and have a great week.